International Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
Hello, everybody. I'm Katie Kelly. I'm Senior Director at ICMA, and I'm delighted to be able to introduce to you today Sunhee Park, who is a Senior Counsel at the EBRD and has been for approximately 16 years. Sunhee and I have a bit of history. We both worked together at Linklaters way back at the start of 2000 or so. And since then, since we both left Linklaters and moved on to other things, Sunhee has been an outstanding proponent of ICMA and regularly attending all our events and inputting into a lot of our work. So we're delighted to have that engagement from Sunhee and indeed to have this discussion today. Now, this is the first time at ICMA and particularly at the Women's Network that we have explored issues associated with race in any depth. We've explored many issues in the context of gender, which has probably risen quite quickly up the agenda recently as it's been more exposed in recent years, such as around gender pay gap issues or the spotlight on female representation in the boardroom and the hashtag MeToo movement, etc. But of course, debates around racism have been a staple of political discussion for at least half a century. So much so, maybe, that racism has become almost a constant. And maybe the debate about race has become muted to an extent and lost some of its urgency. So the first question I'd like to ask Sunhee is how the murder of George Floyd and the reignition of the Black Lives Matter movement, how has that catapulted racism back onto the agenda and become so relevant to everyone, including professionals like you, Sunhee, who've enjoyed such longevity of career in the city?
There was a danger and a concern that talk about diversity was falling off the agenda until George Floyd's killing happened at the end of May. And that has definitely brought it out to the fore again. But that's prompted me to think more about what racism looks like in the city, because there also seems to be a complacency somewhat of the fact that in Britain, we don't do racism like George Floyd. And therefore, there is no problem with racism. But the way that most people of color face racism is not that kind of racism, right? It's more what I call the everyday racism, which is more subtle. It's off camera. It's difficult to pinpoint and say that's racist. This is why it's been very difficult to actually have racism and diversity matters on the agenda. But thank goodness there is one good outcome out of this, and that the conversation, difficult conversations, are taking place. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. You guys were very instrumental in me getting involved in the diversity space. When I first got working in the city, which is, 23 plus years ago, no organization had internal networks. So women's networks or, Asian networks, Black Korean networks, there was nothing of the kind, right? These are more recent kind of involvement. And even at ICMA, so the women's network, I think, was formed in 2016.
That sounds about right.
So I got involved because you guys asked EBRD to host the flagship women's networking event for 2017. And because I'm I'm the principal delegate to ICMA from EBRD, I thought it was great that I do a opening remark and maybe somebody from the women's network at EBRD, which again is only about 5 or 6 years old, made a few remarks too. So I emailed the women's network group and I got no response. And then a couple of days later, I realized why, because the leadership committee was stepping down and they wanted new people to get involved. And so I thought, well, if this is the only way to get EBRD's women's network recognized for the work that they do, then I'm going to get involved in the women's network. And so I stood for election, got elected. I'm one of the leaders of the women's network at EBRD. And that's how I became exposed to the issues regarding gender. But also I got invited to not just women's network events, but also other events, all kinds of diversity events. And that's when my eyes were opened. And I'm not trying to say that I've never been the subject of racism, sexism, but I thought when I did, those were pockets of ignorance. I didn't realize that the problem was more endemic than that.
So wow.
Instrumental in me getting involved in this space.
Well, I'm delighted that we were able to offer you a platform and an opportunity to get involved, Sunhee, because I think that's to everybody's gain. Obviously, there's quite a large community of, let's say, BAME individuals in the city. And I know you've also suggested that there's not necessarily a lack of talent or pipeline, but more a lack of maybe opportunity or a lack of retention and an almost unconscious stifling lack of opportunity for people of colour. Do you have anything more to say about that?
I don't think there's any question about the fact that diversity is important for organizations and that they should reflect the population that they serve. There are study after study that shows that diversity brings 15% more profitability. If they're gender diverse, the profitability goes up by 15%. If they're racially diverse, the profitability of an organization goes up by 35%.
Wow, that's pretty significant.
There's no question about the benefits, and never mind the ethical issues of it's the right thing to do. So this is why the top levels of organizations get it. So I think we've moved beyond the question of, do we need diversity? The question is, how do we get diversity? Why don't we have it? And like I said, so racism and the challenges that are faced by people of color doesn't stop when you get to the top either. We have a president who has stepped down over lockdown period because he has served two terms and his term has come to an end. So we're in the process of appointing a new president for EBRD. So the poor president couldn't even get a well-deserved send-off. He had to do it by Zoom. So I listened to his leading speech on Zoom, and he was talking about his achievements, what he wanted to achieve, what he felt he achieved, and the challenges that he faced. And one of the things in terms of challenges that he was talking about was racism. And I think, you know, and this is the president.
Wow.
Right? And I just assumed that he was talking about racism that he encountered when he was on his way to the top. No, he was actually talking about racism that was directed at him when he was president.
Really? That is staggering.
So imagine what life is like for everybody else, you know, under him.
I think maybe there is a bit of a perception about ethnicity and gender diversity that people are maybe afraid of getting it wrong and don't want to be accused of positive discrimination, which of course itself even has negative connotations. But what measures can be put in place to encourage retention of talent at a lower level and support that talent right through to the presidential level in a way which is meaningful and thoughtful and doesn't come across as box ticking or virtue signaling?
Well, I think people have to think beyond their short-termism. So most people don't want to go out of the way to think beyond their, I suppose, immediate circle, to think, well, who is the better person for the job in terms of what input they can give to the organization? So they're very short-sighted. They recruit on an affinity bias basis, so which is why they will be surrounded by people who either look like them or think like them. What I call the yes men will amplify their own thoughts anyway. So it's not just women or people of color who face retaliation when they actually speak out. You know, it is anybody, right? Which is why there is this fear of what you just said, retaliation. That is why people are fearful of speaking out. But you know, the difficult conversations, the courageous conversations must be had. In the legal profession, there is no shortage of talent. So at the junior end, in fact, minorities are overrepresented because the latest statistics say that there's 18% minorities at the very junior level, but in the general population, the figure of minorities is 14%, 15% or thereabouts. So there is a slight overrepresentation. It's just that progression doesn't occur, right? So retention is difficult, progression is not possible, which is why people leave, right? So if they can't get to where they want to get to, why would they put in more time and energy staying in that organization? They'll go elsewhere. So let me give you an example of what I heard about in an organization where they have three levels of management. So a simple organization, three levels of management, level one being the lowest and level three being the highest. So there was somebody who applied for a level one managerial position, got rejected. And I don't know the ins and outs of why that person got it rejected. It could be he was wearing the wrong tie on the day, whatever. But why? He was interviewed by various people. But the ultimate yay or nay came down to his line manager. So his immediate line manager. So despite the fact that he may have gotten positive reviews from other people, the line manager ultimately said no, and he didn't make it. A few months down the line, he came on board as the top level, tier three. So becoming the boss to the level two manager who rejected him. So how did this happen? Because at the very senior level, the recruitment happens on a panel basis. It is more difficult for your bias to come through and be justified if you are in a panel. This, again, goes to the advantage of having diversity. One of the benefits is that you will make better decisions, and on the whole, consensus-driven decisions are better. So this is provable, right? I mean, that's not to say it works all the time. And also, if you have like-minded people who amplify your own voice around you, then you're clearly not going to get a proper consensus-driven decision anyway. So it doesn't work all the time. But on the whole, I think panel interviews tend to work better because of this reason.
Well, I think that makes sense. So you're not at the mercy of the affinity bias that you mentioned earlier of one person. You know, you're looking at a pool of different inputs, which is very important.
And yeah, this is why the tone set from the top is very important. But right now, for example, leadership doesn't look too great in the world. If they hear something that they don't want to hear, too bad, there's the door. And that is the mentality, which is why, I mean, sure, it's great that organizations, what organization doesn't have great sounding policies, anti-discrimination, mm-hmm. you know, respect in the workplace, mm-hmm. harassment-free workplace policies. But who's monitoring them? So are they just lip service? Or is HR actually doing an active job of monitoring? Is anybody bringing a claim, or are they such a perfect organization that no claims are made?
Yeah.
And if claims are brought, who is bringing those claims and what are the outcomes? Is it always, you know, judged in favor of the organization? So who's going to bring a claim then?
So would you be in favor of kind of visibility on these types of metrics so that you can actually follow a company and check its profile, check what it's doing, check how it's addressing racial and other discriminatory issues so that you can actually quantify it?
Well, I mean, it depends on how much data that an organization is willing to put out.
Yeah.
We can have data overload, right? But
yeah.
One thing that you can do is to make a public statement as to your intent, which makes you accountable. I think one of the main problems for many organizations is that there's no accountability. So if you don't have a short list that consists of a diverse group of people, what's the consequence of that? Probably nothing, right? So why is it a surprise that no person of color gets selected for a promotion or a job opening? That should have come as a surprise.
Just to pick you up on one of the points that you mentioned earlier about retaliation and calling out discrimination, I think it takes a big person to call out discrimination of all kinds. And I think everyone would like to think they're the type of people who would step in and stop it. But according to research from the HR consultancy Pern Candola, the reality is that most of us don't do anything. I wonder why that is. Maybe it's because we think it's not our problem or we don't want to get involved. But often it could maybe be a form of self-protection. We're afraid of recriminations or coming across as whistleblowers. And I think often it can also be the case that it's the infrastructure of the work environment that doesn't necessarily lend itself well to, you know, confronting and challenging discrimination or reporting it. So do you think you could give any guidance for firms about how to go about implementing policies so that people can report racist practice or just racist tendencies that they've picked up in a way which it is sensitive to the actual case itself, but it's without fear of reproach or adverse consequences for the person reporting it?
Again, that's a very complex question, right? Because it's, yes, the form, the reasons why people don't speak up is all of those things that you've mentioned. You know, it depends on who is in the organization at the time and who is at the receiving end of those complaints at the time. So it's all moving pieces, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, this is why accountability is the most important piece. So have you done something about somebody who's complained about racist treatment or sexist treatment? What have you done about it? And if you haven't, then why haven't you? And were there any consequences for the manager who was behaving in an inappropriate manner? And if there isn't, then why would anybody report? So again, that also combines with the cultural aspect that I've spoken about, you know, the culture from the top.
Mm.
Basically ensure that it is okay to speak up and that we are an inclusive organization. And that is a tone that can only be set up from the top.
So when it comes to accountability, which I get you're saying is the most important aspect, can you think in any sense, in any practical ways, how would you advise firms to be more accountable? What practical steps could they take to be accountable and to develop a meaningful race strategy, in particular in our markets where we find we're predominantly male, predominantly white, and sometimes it can be difficult to enshrine big transitional shifts which are required really to deal with these issues?
So I've swung from one end to the other in the last few years because I've been involved in the diversity space myself. So when I first started out working in the city, I was one of these people who said, women having issues with sex, it must be a case of sour grapes. People didn't make it to the top, and that's why they're complaining about racism, sexism, or other isms. And now I've swung to the other end, thinking, no, there are definitely barriers, because you look around yourself and see that there are very few people of color at the very top, which is why data-driven policies are going to be the most effective. So let me give you an example of what happened to me 10, 12 years ago. So I was approached out of the blue by a Norwegian company to be on their board. And this is a publicly listed company, right? And I thought, well, we don't operate in Norway. They're not even a shareholder. Why would they come to me to be on their board? And then they were explaining that a Korean company had bought a majority stakeholding in that company. So Norway is one of the very few countries that has a gender quota. So the next board member had to be a woman. And the Korean company said, well, we're happy with that, but it has to be a Korean woman. So they searched around the globe for somebody who had the right skills, you know, who was willing to go to Norway once a quarter for their board meetings. So it took a while for them to search. But without regulation driving quotas or targets, it's very difficult, I think, to get the figures moving, because there'll always be an excuse. Because ultimately, when it comes down to it, they will say, oh, I can't put my finger on it. But they're not a good fit somehow.
Right, yeah.
So that can be used as an excuse. And if the business side, especially, can justify it saying, well, I don't want to work with that person, then that is the ultimate decision that is made, that that person is not going to get hired. Again, affinity bias will take over, and you will just be surrounded with people who just look like you or think like you, or both.
We do actually see that occasionally. We see, for instance, if we are doing panels or events, we might have a requirement that there's at least 50% gender diversity in the panel. And that often happens from certain regions, which is pretty progressive and actually does really force the organiser, or in your case, your board, to actually make the effort and go and find the right person.
Yeah, but regarding the box ticking, I mean, it is a little bit insulting for people to assume that if you're a person of color and you've made it to a very senior position, this is because of some kind of box-ticking exercise, that you're meeting the race quota. But studies have shown in the States, and again, I don't know whether studies are not done here because the number of minorities is so low, and so to do a study of the few people will make the data statistically unreliable, or because no money's thrown at doing these studies. The U.S., their number of minorities is, I think, at 35% or 40%. And in 20, 25 years' time, apparently the whites are predicted to not be a majority anymore. So studies in the States have shown that if there are two people holding the same title, same position, and one's a person of color and the other one's a white person, the person of color is definitely more qualified to hold the same position. So I don't think there's any fear of somebody being underqualified being promoted to a position that they're not qualified for.
That's very interesting. And that's a good point, actually, about the different, completely different dynamic between the US and here. So maybe it is time that we started actually thinking about a bit more qualitative research with the minorities that we do have here. This kind of segues into a question that I wanted to put to you. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of something called the BAME Over campaign. Basically, its aim is to eradicate the use of the term BAME completely. And I quote from the campaign, BAME was not chosen by those it applies to. It's disempowering, belittling, and it denigrates our distinctiveness, threatening our agency in doing so. It's also lazy, dismissive, othering, and reductive. Now, on the other hand, we've heard from our membership that some feel they're not adequately associated with or captured by BAME. So in a way, the community that it's trying to address is divided on this concept. So do you think that firms generally need to be more aware and nuanced in their categorization and approach to minority groups, rather than just kind of bucketing things as, well, here's a woman's thing, here's a BAME thing, and here's maybe, I don't know, a disability or other kind of bucket? Is that the right way to go about it, or does it require a lot more work?
Well, again, the whole thing is complex, right? Which is why there is no one solution for everybody. Otherwise, everybody will have done it because of what I said, the profitability and element and the benefits to an organization for having a diverse organization. So yes, I totally agree that we're all different. Just because, you know, I'm Korean, I don't have the same lived experience as somebody who is Singaporean, for example. Somebody from the Caribbean with a Caribbean ancestry is not going to be the same as somebody who has ancestry in Africa, for example. We're all different. And not only that, it again will have different experiences if you're a first generation immigrant versus if you're a third generation, for example. So fundamentally, it comes down to treating people like people. Because for me, again, this came late in my life because my father was a diplomat, a career diplomat. So he's only ever had one employer, and that was the Korean government. I grew up all over the world. So I started traveling, being on a plane from the time I was 3 months old. And for me, I realized very quickly that people are people no matter what their skin color is. So that has never been an issue for me. But what I didn't realize was that that's not how most people felt. Because most people still go by what they first see, and that is your skin color. So this is where the perceptions come from. And also another thing that I've come to realize that if somebody forms a negative opinion of someone, it takes a very, very long time to actually debunk that opinion. So it comes down to the thought process that goes on there. But most people, once they've made a decision about someone, and that's a negative one, they don't want to change that decision. So they will find evidence to support their idea in the first place, which may be the wrong one. So then this just, you know, compounds the problem. But again, for me, I have more in common probably with other people who are diplomats' kids, grew up as diplomats' kids, than somebody who grew up in Korea. I've spent very little time in Korea. So we're all different, and it would be great if everybody is treated individually rather than the whole umbrella of BAME. There's so few of us. There's only 15%. There's so few of us. If we try to segment, okay, this is how I'm different from you, right, despite the fact that our skin color may be the same or different, there is no end to that. Let's just treat everybody like humans.
Sunny, I think that's a lovely way to punctuate the end of this podcast. A really nice message. Treat people as people. Try to see beyond the color. So it just remains for me to thank you very much for giving up your time today, Sunny. I know you're very busy. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And we are hoping to be able to see you at our events, either virtually or in person, as soon as we can. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you for listening to this ICMA podcast. For more podcasts and more information about capital markets, check out our website, icmagroup.org.